Coming to you live from the Badminton Championships, I'm Johannes Stauffer, and with me as always are some kind of feathery balls.
They're called shuttlecocks!
And this is the Mildly Alarming Podcast. Episode 111, Disaster Toilet Control. Welcome back to the Mildly Alarming Podcast. I'm Johannes Stauffer, and our show's a little bit different this week. We're starting off with an interview we did with Chip Beauvais, who has a new game up on Kickstarter this week as of the release of this episode, called Smoke and Mirrors. So we talked to him about the game, about his design process a little bit, about a game he designed previously called Chroma Cubes. And then in the second segment, we get a little more into the mechanics of the game. So I hope you like it, and we're just going to move right into that interview now. Enjoy. We are here with Chip Beauvais, designer of Chroma Cubes and of the game that we're talking about today, which is called Smoke and Mirrors, which is on Kickstarter by the time this comes out, probably right now, and you could go check it out. I'm Johannes Stauffer.
And I'm Tom Rich.
Yep, I'm Chip Beauvais.
And I think it's worth noting that here, in this sense, refers to the internet generally. We didn't manage to put ourselves in the same room, so you could imagine whatever setting you would like for this. I'm picturing a pirate ship myself.
It's a good recording space.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah, I was picturing a nice open beach with relaxing waves coming in, but they were relaxing until I realized that there's a pirate ship on the horizon that's heading right towards me.
I'm thinking a little more technically. I just like both of your settings because any horrible staticky background noise that might be happening, I can just chalk up to waves and no one thinks I'm a bad audio engineer anymore.
Excellent. Background noise.
Yep. Yeah, it's just the waves. Just enjoy it. I can add some seagull sounds.
I'm hoping that's going to happen, right? There will be seagull sounds.
I'll see what I can do. So we know Chip largely through Twitter, through the Board Game Hour that we've mentioned before on the show, where board game nerds get together when they probably should be working, given the time, at least for us in the Eastern Standard Time Zone, and talk about a series of questions of board games. And I've always been struck at how well how much I agree with what Chip has to say, where people are bashing one thing or touting another. He always has something clever to say, and I generally agree with him. So I'm really happy to have you on the show, and I'm pretty excited about your game and seeing it come out and being able to give you dollars for it. I understand you've had a print and play version of it for a while, but seeing it published seems pretty cool.
Yes, I'm very excited. The print and play version is, was using sort of clip art, and it's a very sort of abstract, simple, would this mechanism work in a game? And seeing it all sort of come together with a lot of the background, the theming, and the story that Jason Tagmeier, my publisher, from Button Shy Games, and seeing it all come together with the new art has really been quite an experience.
Who's doing the art?
The art is by Fabrice. His last name begins with a W. I don't have it right in front of me. But he did all of the card artwork, and the cover illustration for the game is done by Sarah Beauvais, who is my wife.
I saw we were looking through some of the interviews from when Chroma Cubes came out on Board Game Geek and a couple other things, saw that your wife did some of the artwork there. That's pretty cool that you're able to work with her on your game designs.
Yeah, it's really excellent because she's absolutely a gamer. She really actually got me into the hobby years ago when we met. And so she is very sensitive to to what the game needs. So mm-hmm. in addition to sort of art direction, she can look at, in particular for Chroma Cubes, she could look at a particular aspect of the drawing and say, no, this is going to be unbalanced for game reasons, in addition to how the artwork visually looks.
That's great. Both of our wives are generally not gamers. We've foisted a few prototypes on them and tried to get them to do some playtesting, and mostly we get some valuable feedback, but the valuable feedback is generally people who aren't already into tabletops are not going to enjoy or purchase this game.
Yes, yes.
If there's an yep. iPhone in arm's reach, that's the thing that is going to grab the attention.
Yeah, it's interesting. There are different stages to playtesting, and there are times when you just need another human being there to, you know, to manipulate the pieces and to make decisions that you're not anticipating. I think that Ignacy Chevychek wrote a series of articles about the three different types of playtesters. And the first type that you need is a silent playtester, someone who will follow the rules and move the components. But at this early stage, generally your game is going to be pretty bad. So you don't want or necessarily need to hear feedback on it. You just need to see how it works. And Ignacius has said that his wife, Mary, plays this role for him in the initial silent playtester stage. So my wife has played a number of my games, and she's always very honest with her feedback. And she generally tries to be encouraging, like, well, this game, you know, there might be a game in here somewhere. I think she knows which games I dislike, and so she'll compare some of my games to those if she's not enjoying them.
I saw on Board Game Geek you said you describe yourself as a Euro gamer. The two games we've seen from you, though, aren't particularly Euro in their execution. Why do you think that is?
That's an interesting observation. I think that I think what I like about games is I like the systems optimization challenge of games, and I think I find that more in Euro games than I do in you know, in more thematic games.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, so Chroma Cubes in particular is, if you know, you could certainly play it casually and to have fun with your family and to fill in, you know, get to color with crayons. But if you're trying to win, then there's a lot of resource optimization in terms of deciding which dice you're going to use and when, and which parts of the puzzle you're going to try to complete in which order.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually increased when you also consider the ability of players to trade dice. So in Chroma Cubes, there's each die is weighted differently towards what colors it can roll. So with the trading aspect, you can trade away all of your red dice for blue dice, and you've changed the probability of rolling particular colors. Now, if you do this strategically, bearing in mind the parts of the puzzle that are left for you to complete, then you can really sort of tune this. And if you're just, you know, if you're just slightly more efficient at using your dice than your opponent, you have a better chance to win. So that feels to me very much like a mechanic that you would see in a Euro game.
Yeah. It's funny. We went to Protospiel a couple weekends ago up here in Chelsea, Michigan. And so one of the questions I wanted to ask you based on our observations there is, as a game designer, what branch of IT are you in? And listening to you talk about systems optimization, I'm going to guess you're a software developer.
I am. That's true.
Nailed it.
I don't usually try to let that bleed into my game design hobby, but
sometimes it's a little bit inevitable. Although it's interesting what analogies you can draw from. One of the mechanisms in Smoke and Mirrors is when one player challenges another, the player that's correct to the player that remains in the game gets to take one of the cards from the eliminated player. And we found that in a fast-moving game, the amount of time it took to resolve the victor taking one of the eliminated player's cards, it sort of disrupted the flow if it took too long. So we initially had to use magic terminology, Magic the Gathering terminology, we initially had a blue looter ability where the player, the victor, would take one of the eliminated player's cards and then decide, or would look at all of them and decide which one he would keep. And that really sort of introduced too much analysis paralysis or too much AP to the game. So to the red looter ability in Magic, which is you discard first, and then you just take what the card that was in the suit that you discarded. So by reducing the decision space, we sped up that aspect of the game, and that really improved things and kept things flowing.
Well, let's jump into talking about Smoke and Mirrors here. We took a look at it because we're just terrible, unprofessional, lousy podcasters.
Terrible podcasters.
We didn't get a chance to play it yet. Hopefully we'll do that in the second segment here coming up. But we did take a look at it, and what struck me is that it really looks a lot like, not to say that it's derivative, but a lot of what we like about the game Coup. Which is another card game with a very heavy bluffing mechanic where there's a lot of interplay between the players and the same sort of deal where if you bluff and someone calls you on it and they're right, you're out. Or, well, you lose influence in that case. You can bluff twice unsuccessfully before you're out. And likewise, if someone calls your bluff and you are not actually bluffing, they lose influence. And I really like how Smoke and Mirrors has taken that, and it's sort of simplified it. I don't want to say, again, taken it, not like you stole it, but it does a similar thing. But it simplifies it. It seems like it could be a lot faster, a lot more streamlined, and also allow a lot more of that interplay between the characters or the players without having to know so much about how the different cards work. In Coup, you've got different character types that do different things. In Smoke and Mirrors, it's pretty straight numbers. And that's pretty interesting. It allows for a lot more subtle bluffing and subtle interplay between the players. Tom said it reminded him of Skulls. Is that what it's called?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Skulls. Skull and Roses, I think, is another name for it. It's kind of flies under a number of monikers.
Yes. I remember I've seen pictures of people playing Skull and Roses, or just Skull. And I'm more familiar with Coup. I have a copy of Coup, and I've played it a number of times. I think the comparisons that you draw are apt. We've played a lot with the different possible distributions of the three decks in Smoke and Mirrors. And one of the things that we kept coming back to is there are different distributions of numbers that would make a more mathematically interesting game. But we really want to get the game and the math out of the way so that players can focus on interacting with each other. So in Coup in particular, you've got the coins that you try to accumulate over the course of the game to do different things, and you've got the different characters that you need to know about. And the interesting thing about the characters is it's not enough when you're starting a game of Coup to know the two characters that you have in front of you and what they do. you need to know what characters you do not have in front of you do, so that you can bluff as though you had them. And that's something that, that advanced players can get to, but it's a little bit of a, not a barrier to entry, but sort of a learning curve. And Smoke and Mirrors is more accessible because, as you say, it's taking something simple that people are familiar with, you know, with just a sequence of increasing numbers. And very quickly, people recognize the patterns in the three different suits. And so once you've played through a round or two, then you've got all the tools that you need to mechanically understand the game. And then everything else becomes, oh, how do I interpret what the player before me just did? To figure out whether they're telling the truth or lying, or are they setting a trap for me? Mm-hmm. So that's really, there are certainly opportunities in the development of this game where we made the decision to keep things simple. So actually, I'll give you an example of this. Is at one point the At one point, we found that, mathematically speaking, there weren't a lot of hands that you could combine to produce the number three. So the first player had to produce one, the second player had to produce two, and so on. And so there was a bit of a disadvantage in being the third player. And one of the attempts that we took to sort of fix this problem was to just add a card of value 3 to each of the three different suits. So each player has one card from each suit. By increasing the number of 3s that are available, we've now sort of solved that problem and sort of changed the probabilities so that there's not this sort of dip in the probability curve when you get to step 3. The problem with that, though, is then you don't... You know, you lose part of the elegance of having one suit that's all purely ones except for one special mirror card, and another suit that's all purely fives except for one mirror card. So adding a three to each of them, while it made for a more mathematically interesting game, it was too much of a speed bump for players to get into the game and to sort of put the mechanics of the game aside, so that they could really focus on what their opponents were doing. And that was really the type of game that we wanted mm-hmm. to create.
I'm pretty excited to play it. I think just from looking at it, you've done a pretty good job of that. I think if you'd had the 1-3, in each, of the three decks, that would be too much for me to try to keep in my head, even if there was no chance of my ever doing it. Just being like, okay, there's a three in there somewhere, I need to know who has it, or all my ability to figure out who's bluffing is thrown out the window. I think that's good. I'm really pretty excited to get some play of this game going.
I would agree with that too, but what one thing I wanted to comment on with the game that was pretty interesting to me was that the decks are going in different colored sleeves, and you're getting cards from each deck in each player's hand. So I wind up with like a green, a blue, and a yellow card all in my hand. So the other players know it does some interesting stuff with hidden information for the other players about what's going on in each person's hand.
Yeah.
You know that the yellow cards have one set they're drawing from, the blue from another, and the green from a third. So if I'm down my yellow card, that adjusts in a different way than having a single deck would what you know about what I've got. I wonder if you might tell us a bit about how that element of the game came about.
Sure. That's a really good question. And just so you know, for Kickstarter reasons, the copy that you have, the sleeves are not going to be in the final produced version. And the produced version, there'll be, there'll be regular cards, and they'll each have a different back mm-hmm. design. Mm-hmm. So we're sort of emulating that with a different card sleeves. So And so each player has, throughout the game, each player will have three cards in their hand, one from each of the different suits. And as you point out, when you put, you know, for the first turn, so one of the suits, the star suit, has is all ones, and then the skull suit is all fives, again, except with one special mirror card for each suit. And then the spiral suit has one each of one through five. So the thing about the spiral suit is that if you're holding on to each card is, each number is unique. So if you're holding on to the spiral four and the previous player puts down one spiral card and says, this is a four, well, you know that they're lying. But if they put down, multiple cards, then, for each number that they're trying to produce, there's usually more than one way that they could be producing the that particular sum. So the backs of the cards being public information is absolutely a key part of the game. So to sort of go back to the inspiration for the game, one of the things I was thinking about was misprinted cards. So the idea is that you would have cards where almost all of them said on the back of them exactly what was on the front. So you could look at one and say, okay, I know that that card is a one. But then there would be a intentionally misprinted card where the back of it was lying. And so you'd flip it over and then you'd say, oh, I thought this was a one, but it's actually something else. And that was that idea led me to design a prototype, I think it was either 3 or 4 years ago, where it was a different theme, where each card was either a merchant who is carrying some valuable jewels, a thief who is trying to rob the merchant, or a guard that would prevent the thief from stealing the gems from the merchant. And so on the back of each card, it would say, you know, this is, you know, it would say, I am a thief. And when you flip most of them over, they would say, yes, yes, I am a thief. But one of them, you would flip over the thief card and would say, aha, I'm actually a guard instead. So that sets up sort of a rock, paper, scissors mechanism, mm-hmm. where if I think there are mostly merchants out there, I want to play my thief. Whereas if I think there are mostly thieves on the board, I want to play my guard and arrest them, because that's where you get victory points from. Or if I think there's mostly guards out there, then I want to play my merchant, because my gems will, I'll be able to transport my gems safely. And so this was an idea that I had early on, and I knew it would take a lot of tuning to say, well, if I have, you know, if I have 10 cards, then I want 8 of them to be correct. I want 8 of them to be as advertised when you flip them over, and one of them will be, you know, I've got 2 other options, and I'll have one of each, and sort of figuring out the distribution of the cards is kind of where I got stuck in that prototype. And so I put that aside, and then recently I saw that Jason was producing cards in his wallet series. And the wallet series, all the games in the wallet series are limited to a set of components that will fit into a plastic wallet that is sold as part of the game. And so that meant that I only had 18 cards to work with. And so when I started thinking about what games do I have that would fit into this model, I remembered the game that I worked on, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, and had been just sitting in a box on my game shelf. And I sort of brought it down and started playing with it again. But I tried to abstract it away to just being numbers and producing a particular sum of numbers. And that abstract game is really sort of what eventually evolved into Smoke and Mirrors.
That's really cool. We actually, our current baby that we're working on is called Big Man, and we set out to build a game that would fit in your pocket and be playable on a lunch table on a lunch break. And it's gotten yes. beyond that. It's compact, but it's not that compact.
And it's not brief.
It's certainly not brief. And we love it, and we're going to go with it where the game is taking us, but that was where we started with it. So it's cool that there are games out there that were capable of doing that, even though we weren't.
Well, you know, it's really not important where the game begins, because, again, as I said, my game was much more... began with a much different theme than Smoke and Mirrors, and it could have taken off in a completely different direction. Even the initial version had around twice as many cards as Smoke and Mirrors does. But I think that it's important. I was actually reading an article today about I think the title of the article was "Stop Trying to Be Creative." And the idea was that creativity doesn't strike... creativity is a different process from knowing what your objective is and taking clear steps towards that objective. And it's more important to, as you put it, let the game guide you into... let the game sort of reveal to you what parts of it are fun and then chop away everything else. So it's really less important what objective you start off with, and it's more important to have the openness to discover sort of what the game wants to be.
Yeah. Well, we're coming to the end of our time here. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we tell everyone where we can find your game and back you on Kickstarter?
Sure. So I should point out that... that this Kickstarter campaign, as I said, it's Jason Tagmeier is running it for Buttonshy Games, and he's doing something that I think is unique. I don't know of any other game that's any other Kickstarter campaign that's done this. Is he's running a campaign for three different games simultaneously. So as part of the campaign, you can get Smoke and Mirrors, which I've designed. You can also get a game called North-South-East Quest by J.R. Honeycutt, and a game called Fever Chill by Ken Thompson. And they're all very different games, and they'll each appeal to a different type of audience, and they provide different experiences. So I hope that my description of Smoke and Mirrors encourages all your listeners to go and check out the Kickstarter. But even if it doesn't, I would definitely recommend checking it out, because there are two other very different games that are worth your attention.
Great. Could they find that Kickstarter once it's live by searching for Smoke and Mirrors on Kickstarter, or is there something else they should look for?
I think the best term to search for is going to be Buttonshy. That's the name of the company. Mm-hmm.
We should be able
to... Or you could search for Wallet Games.
We should be able to get it in the show notes.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
So...
Yes. Yep. I'll make sure that you have a link in the show notes.
Great. So we're going to be either before this, you will have already heard us do a mildly alarming plays, or after this segment, you will hear us do a mildly alarming plays, depending on which way we decide to go when we finally put the show together.
We're very good podcasters.
Yeah, just super professional, high-quality stuff here.
I chuckled there for a moment because you said all of our listeners in the plural, as though there is more than one, because I don't listen to it after it's done. So really, it's just Johannes.
I know. I listen to it. My mom listens to it.
Oh, yeah. There you go. Excellent.
So if you want to find out more about this game, you can follow Chip on Twitter. He's at Flying Sheep, which is just a fantastic Twitter handle.
I'm surprised it was available. I would have thought that one would have gone back when Twitter launched.
I hate to sort of burst the bubble there, but at Flying Sheep was not available.
Oh.
So I needed to emphasize that I am the original. So my Twitter handle is at the underscore flying sheep.
Oh,
so
is
that's
that true?
THE the underscore flying sheep.
Good thing you pointed that out. How did I get that wrong? Because I'm terrible at what I do. That's how.
Well, you know, you would be better if you didn't have, you know.
I mean, that's exactly the effect I'm going for. So I'm glad the illusion works.
It only works for you so far, though, until we start following whoever actually has flying sheep. His game is called Smoke and Mirrors. It'll be on Kickstarter starting August 12th through August 29th. Go ahead, give it a look. It seems pretty entertaining. Is the print play still going to be up during that time, or is that going to disappear?
There will be a print and play version that's available. If it's not on the campaign, feel free to ping me on Twitter, and I'll make sure that you get a copy of it.
Great. So you can take a look at the print play and get an idea of what you're in for when you inevitably back this, because it looks so super-duper great, and you value our opinions on games so very, very much here at the Mildly Alarming Podcast. So thank you so much for joining us, Chip. It's been a lot of fun.
Yep, and thanks for being here.
We hope to see your Kickstarter successful and see more stuff from you in the future.
Thank you. This was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed chatting with you guys.
Thanks.
Born in the sweet Carolina sunshine, hand-shaped by master crafters, many from families that have been doing this for generations, just like you always thought you remembered it, Uncle Pepperdine's Fleasius Bermjacks has that rich aroma and smooth caramel color that everybody thinks it ought to have. Rub it on your hands and feel the warm, toasted nature work its way in. That's how you know it's a real Uncle Pepperdine Fleasius Bermjacks. Well, that and the smooth sound and good function you'll have after you apply the Bermjacks. Just bake at 350 degrees for 22 minutes, and your Fleasius Bermjacks will be scampering around the kitchen, just like old Spotchy used to do when you were a boy. Now we know that our Fleasius Bermjacks cost more than a few Jefferson Davis nickels, but don't you worry. You can take it home today and put it in your living room, and just pay what you can down at the corner store, by and by. We know you're good for it, and you'll be proud to show the Reverend your Fleasius Bermjacks when he comes by for supper. And that's okay. Uncle Pepperdine's Fleasius Bermjacks. Sold by the barrel, the bag, or the Cossack's pound. Just like you might think you did want once.
Welcome back to the Mildly Alarming Podcast. I'm Johannes.
And I'm Tom.
And we're back.
And we're front.
To the Mildly Alarming Podcast.
To the Mildly Alarming Podcast.
That's what we're back to.
That's where we are.
We are there.
We are in that location. Isn't it nice?
It's pretty okay, I guess.
Yeah. I know, right? It's pretty cool. Pretty
so cool. How about that interview we totally just finished with Chip, huh?
Yeah, it was a pretty good interview.
Just right now, we just finished it.
Yeah.
Just right before that commercial break.
Well, how else would that have happened since this is a live show?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
What did we talk about in that interview?
Well, we talked about how Chip is running for president of the United States.
I'd vote for him.
Me too.
I don't know if I would vote for him. We actually recorded that interview several weeks ago, and we need to make good on some promises that we made, perhaps drunkenly, during the recording of filling you in a little bit more on the game. We were hoping to do an on-air play of Smoke and Mirrors, which is Chip's game, which is on Kickstarter right now as you're listening to it, though not quite yet as we're recording this. But I don't think it's going to translate very well to on-air play, so we're going to give you a quick rundown of how the game actually works. We may repeat some stuff that we said in the interview, but you never really expected this to be good in the first place. So,
well, two, if you wanted input on the show, you would leave comments places. You have only yourselves to blame for the way that we behave
on
the air.
To be fair, they could be following the final direction for leaving comments that we give in each episode and, like, firing arrows into the air or screaming them into the ether writing hip-hop songs. I don't know what we've told them to do.
No, we'd get those. We say every time, we'll get it if you do that.
Right, and if you say it, that makes it true.
Yeah, I'm not a liar.
If you take one thing home from this show, kids, it's that if you say it, that makes it true.
Good, solid reasoning, an excellent way to proceed through life. But here's the rundown on Smoke and Mirrors. So Smoke and Mirrors is kind of a bluffing game. You got
kind of nothing. It is exclusively a bluffing game.
So you got three decks, each with six cards in it.
Sounds right.
First deck, also each deck is a different colored back.
Well, that's our test copy.
Or goes in a different colored sleeve.
Right. The final one you get on Kickstarter, I believe, will have different artwork on the back.
Yeah. So you can easily distinguish which deck is which. Each player is going to get one card from each deck. The first deck, the cards on it are all ones except for one of them, which is a mirror. More on what a mirror is later. The second deck has values from 1 to 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and a mirror. And the third deck is all fives except for the one card that's a mirror. So you're going to get one card from each of these decks. The first player is going to need to play what card down with a value of 1. Or at least he's going to have to declare that the card he plays is going to be has a value of 1.
Yep.
The next player, unless the next player calls, you can only call the person who plays right before you. The next player will then have to play a value of 2 or declare they're playing a value of 2. And so on all the way around. So the goal is to get as high as you can without being called a liar and without accidentally calling somebody a liar when they weren't.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, now this might sound like it would be pretty obvious because there's some numbers that are extremely difficult to make with the values you're going to have available in the deck.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where the mirrors comes in. If you play more than one card and one of them is a mirror, the mirror counts as one of the other cards you played. So if you play a 1 and a mirror, that mirror is also a 1. So you can use the mirrors to kind of bluff your way and buffalo your way toward the value you want.
Buffalo.
Yeah, it's a term.
Buffalo, 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 buffalo.
Buffalo, buffalo. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Look it up.
So that's kind of the neat thing it's got going on there. Mirrors played by themselves are worth 0, and mirrors with other mirrors are also zeros.
Correct.
Because they're mirroring 0. They're mirroring each other and it's 0.
But because the whole game is about bluffing, it almost doesn't matter. You could just play a mirror and be like, 7.
Right.
And if people are not paying attention, then, like Tom,
they might just let it go.
We played just before recording this, and I claimed to have a card that he had in his hand, but I didn't know that, and he didn't call my bluff because he wasn't paying attention. And then, so on his turn, he played that card, claiming it was for the same value. And I was like, there's no way he didn't call my bluff. And so I called his bluff, and he actually did have that
card.
It was
a cunning plan.
It was not a plan at all. You were like, oh, yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. So last man standing in a given round gets a point.
And first of 4 points.
Is the winner.
Is the winnest.
Yeah. So it's pretty light. It's pretty straightforward. It's definitely component light, because it's going to be part of that wallet games thing.
Yep.
So it's not going to take up an absolute pile of space. What do we like about Smoke and Mirrors?
I like a lot about it. I like how it hits a lot of the same buttons as Coup, but it doesn't take so long to play, and it's a lot simpler to teach. It's very... As we've played it, it's competitive, but it's not as... I'm going to burn your house down competitive as Skull or Skulls and Roses.
Mm-hmm.
Which is another similar bluffing kind of game. So it's lighter. Like, my wife plays it and is fine with it. And we get along after the game is over. So that's good.
Yeah, it's always good.
I like that it fits in a pocket. I like that. Yeah, it's quick. It's light. What do you like about it?
Quickly, I really admire what he does with... what do you call it? What's the word I want here?
I don't have a clue.
Hidden information. And the information that's available to each player. Because by differentiating the different colored backs of the cards, you still hide exactly what's in somebody's hand, but you narrow down the band of what it can be. Like, you know that my yellow card, for example, from our set, is either a 1 or a mirror.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got... You still don't know exactly what I have, but you've got more info than you would if I just had a blank back, a hand of cards that just had the same backs.
Yeah.
That's an interesting idea. to be able to narrow down exactly what's in the hand that way by based on the back of the card. And I think it's something worth exploring in larger games, especially in deck builders. I think that has a lot of potential where, like, you could do, oh, just off the top of my head, because I always go straight to fantasy strategy type games, you could have your deck represent your army, and the different colored backs represents the race of the troops in it, but you don't know exactly what kind of dwarf I hired, but you know based on the red back that I've been hiring.
That I've been
hiring a lot of dwarfs because there's a lot of red in my hand.
Gotcha.
And I think that's a cool idea. I don't know that I've seen that anywhere else, where you mix different card backs in one deck to create that kind of information thing. So that's a neat thing, I think.
I've seen it in games with a traditional deck of playing cards that mix more than one deck, but I don't think it's necessarily deliberate. You just sometimes see people playing with a blue deck and a red deck.
Right.
I've never really gotten into games that use playing cards, so I don't know if any of those games do that intentionally, or if they're like, use a blue deck and a red deck, or if it's just people being like, this is what we had on hand.
I think it's probably the latter mostly, but... But yeah, I think that's a cool idea. I like too that the victory condition is pretty customizable, because you can just say, okay, we've each got three, we'll just sudden death it on the night. I guess you would with three anyway. We've each got two, we'll just
because it's first to four. It's not first time there are four. So you wouldn't necessarily, we've each got three. One and there are three of us. Yeah.
We've each got one, but we have to leave in 10 minutes. We'll just sudden death on whoever wins the next round.
Yeah.
You know, or stuff like you, so you can easily scale the victory conditions. I like the quickness. It's fun for something so small. There's a lot of fun packed in there, I think. And gaming is about maximizing your fun per component.
Is it?
Yeah, that's what board games are about.
What if you really like components?
Well, then you're still trying to maximize your fun per component. It's just that in your case, you have a multiplier on the number based on the number of components. It's like it's basically a meta euro laid over top of other board games, where you're tallying up the different modifiers to see how much fun that you actually had.
I hate you a little bit. Yeah,
that sounds like a fun game to put together. Try to put together.
I want to kill you.
Is there anything we think Smoke and Mirrors where Smoke and Mirrors runs afoul or bumps into a problem?
We haven't played it all that much, but I don't know that we certainly haven't run into anything in playing it.
No, I mean it's small and light, so it's not something that's gonna carry your entire gaming evening on its shoulders.
No.
But it does its thing.
Yep.
I like it. I like it a lot.
I think it scales well to different player sizes. His I think is what, three to five?
3 to 5, something like that, yeah.
We played it with two. It worked fine. It wasn't great, but it worked
fine.
It's
fun enough with two. You could play this, too, with people who don't play games. Like, it's simple enough to explain that I feel like I could teach my siblings and parents to play it, and they're not really into board and card games the way I am.
Yeah.
So that would be... That's something it can do.
Plus, then you get to spend a brief part of an evening lying to your family.
Yeah, that's always fun.
That's what Tom likes.
Yeah. I spend most evenings lying to them about, like, what I do for a living.
They still think you're an oil man?
Yep. Spending my days out on the rigs.
Oh, I meant a man made of oil.
Oh.
Like an oil elemental.
No, they puzzled that one out a long time ago. After my older sister, one of the two of them, flicked a match at me and I
didn't
just
immediately combust. Yeah. Okay.
They were like, Tom, you're clearly not a tar elemental. And I'm like, no.
No, you got me.
You figured me out.
This is a terrible podcast.
This is a great podcast. you just have expectations that are wrong about what it should be. So let's look back. Let's keep talking about Smoke and Mirrors. So we're clearly very enthusiastic with it, and we like Chip a lot, and we think that this is a successful design.
Did you see he live tweeted our episode last week?
No, I missed that.
Because we mentioned Smoke and Mirrors in that one, too.
Oh, God, that's terrifying.
And I posted it, and... He started listening to it, and I saw he had like three tweets in a row that were just like references to the podcast, and he tagged us in them. And then at some point he goes, well, apparently I'm live tweeting the latest episode of the Mildly Alarming podcast, and like linked to the episode. He's like, here's where you can find it if you want to ride along, and then did probably five or six more tweets. It was pretty entertaining.
Did he like our podcast?
He didn't say one way or another, but
oh,
he
God,
seemed
oh,
to engage with the parts of it.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
He liked my water softener salt response to
him. That was pretty good. So clearly this is a successful design, and clearly we think that this is going to work out well. You know, it achieves its goals. It's economical. It's well put together. If you were going to continue, like, is there a logical place for this to expand or to grow? Or if you wanted to make it more involved, where you think you would go with it? Like, obviously it works as is, but if we were to say, we like Smoke and Mirrors, we want more of the same.
We want Smoke and Mirrors, the expansion, Smoke and Fire and Mirrors.
Yeah, exactly. Where do you think there's anywhere obvious to include a more complex version or an advanced version or an expansion or anything like that? Or do you think we've pretty well, Chip's pretty well plumbed the depths of where this game would go?
I don't know that you would expand this game, and I think if you were to build on the mechanics, you'd basically build towards something like Coup.
Mm-hmm.
I think he did what he set out to do. I think he made a light, accessible, entertaining bluffing game that is pretty well contained within itself. You could probably shoehorn something into it that may or may not be good. You might come up with something good, but I don't know that it needs it.
Mm-hmm.
I think you would be better off starting afresh if you were to try to make it bigger. I think it doesn't want to be a bigger game, and it wasn't intended to be.
That makes sense. Yeah, my only thoughts of where I would go with it would be more decks with different varying up the values more, which I guess what one place you might go is, like, right now there's three decks, all ones, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and all fives.
Mm-hmm.
You might put in like an extra two decks, say, of different colors that were only odd numbers in a mirror, and then only even numbers in a mirror, and then let players pick which decks they draw from, just to add even a little bit more mystery to it.
I think that might just drag the game out. I mean, he talked to us when we interviewed him about the balancing and time that took, and just trying to basically hit the sweet spot. I think he's at the sweet spot. I think if you were to add, you'd just bog the game down again.
Sure.
I don't think the benefit that you might gain from more mystery, more hidden information would balance out the, now the game is longer, and I already, you know, lose track of who claimed what card was what.
Yeah,
when I'm trying to figure out how to call a bluff, if you add more confusing elements, I think it's just going to be like, I don't freaking know. I guess I'll just call your bluff.
Sure, that makes sense.
Or never call your bluff.
What do you think about the mechanic where you can only call the bluff of the player before you?
I thought that was a little strange, but I think it streamlines the game in that you don't have to deal with tie breaks if two people try to call a bluff. Mm-hmm. Who won then? It could probably work where anyone can call a bluff. And actually, I think we were a little unclear on the rules there, and it may be that anyone can call the bluff.
But it's just the next player gets priority or something like that.
We just chose to interpret in the simplest way because we were a little confused on the rules.
Mm-hmm. That could be.
Well, since he's putting it on Kickstarter, you want to talk about Kickstarter a little bit? I'll just shamelessly steal the Board Game Hour topic from last week again.
I mean, I don't kickstart very much, but
I don't either.
Actually, I've kickstarted twice now.
You've backed twice. You mean?
Yes, I've backed twice. I've never kickstarted.
Kickstarting is having your so.
No, I'm terrified to actually kickstart.
Should we save that for another time?
I don't
want
to
touch on it a little bit.
Let's touch on it a little bit here. If it feels like the conversation's building, we'll come back to it.
Gruul.
We can do whatever we want in life.
I don't think that's entirely true. Like, I can't fly.
Do you want to?
Yes.
Really? I mean, deep down?
Yeah.
Look in your soul.
Who wouldn't? People who are afraid of heights. Though if they could fly, maybe they wouldn't be afraid of heights.
But maybe they would just never fly.
The world may never know.
Let's launch Gary out of a cannon.
That seems like a sound plan.
All right. Kickstarter.
So, Kickstarter. Kickstarter, I find, I'm learning, is like a huge, gigantic part of the gaming community, and not just in that publishers, like, people use it to get their games off the ground. Like, I mean, because people are using it to get games off the ground, I guess gamers use Kickstarter a ton. They back things. They use it to discover new games. They're the sort of people who, like, I've always been kind of baffled by people like Tycho on Penny Arcade who will just look through Kickstarter to see if there's anything cool there that they want to back. Like, I don't have that kind of disposable income, and I would find things that I want to back.
Right.
And then I would want to back them at a level that got me the product, which is usually not the lowest tier.
Yeah.
And I would end up, you know,
well, to...
alone in a ditch, but with a $2,000, you know, coffee machine or something.
Well, too, you're going to want to back them at a level that gets you the cool stuff and all the stretch goals and stuff, too. Like, I mean, it does... Kickstarter does some gamey stuff.
Yeah.
With you know, reward and trying to just push you a little bit more to go all in on it and risk reward. And it,
yeah.
It's kind of neat.
Well, it was interesting to see how many people, like, there was an almost, like, Eurogamer versus Ameritrash gamer kind of polarity between people in the gaming community's approaches to Kickstarter and who should be allowed to kickstart. Mm-hmm. Some people were, especially when the question came up, like, is Kickstarter good for gaming as a hobby? And people came down pretty hard on opposing sides, I think, because some people were like, anything that helps the little guy get published, that's kind of was my approach, anything that helps the little guy get published and get stuff out there that may never have seen market otherwise is good, and if there's some trash in there, that whatever, you know, you take the bad with the good.
Mm-hmm.
There's more good than there would have been otherwise. And other people who were like, no, it's terrible, it's diluting the pool of games with trash, and it's misused and it's bad, and it should be policed, and only great things should be allowed.
Well, I would, if I may jump in.
Yeah, go for
it. I would argue that point with, if the only people who are ever going to see anything that's on Kickstarter, really, are people who are really into games. So you can't really pollute them with trash because they have the knowledge of games to spot it, really. And, like, it would only be, like, I don't think it would be polluting the field if it was, like, in shops where people who were less savvy would be picking it up and encouraging that kind of behavior. I don't understand that critique.
I don't know. Like, the people had valid opinions at any rate on both sides. But, yeah, so Kickstarter, there were some things that just came up because I mentioned it in Board Game Hour, and we've talked about it a lot here. Neither of us has really backed all that much on Kickstarter.
I backed Sales of Glory and that Not Dice thing.
Yeah, I backed Not Dice. I've backed a couple books, like some self-published authors, and I backed a couple video games. I've been really burned on video games on Kickstarter.
Oh, have you?
Kickstarter and, like, Steam Greenlight, or not Greenlight, Early Access, maybe. Mm-hmm. Games where you pay and you're like, either, you know, with Kickstarter, you don't get anything yet. Maybe you will eventually. Or on Greenlight, where you back a game that's not really ready to play yet, and then you've given them your money, but they don't actually go any further with it, and then it just falls apart. So the game I backed on Kickstarter, one of them, I was really excited about it when I backed it, and then I didn't hear anything about it for a year after their Kickstarter was completed, maybe more than a year. And then when I finally heard back from them, they were like, we've changed the name of the game and also everything else about it. And, like, I saw it and I was like, what is this? I don't remember backing this. I don't remember even seeing this. And it turns out it's because the same group of guys, just, they totally changed the game. And I'm like, well, this isn't what I backed.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, it ended up getting published and finished and fairly polished, but it wasn't anything I wanted to play at that point.
Right.
And so there's the danger of that happening. I think it happens a lot more with video games than with board games, but there's the danger of that happening.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's part of, you know, the risk reward, not just the stretch goals, but part of the risk of backing something on Kickstarter. And wow.
You know, maybe bleep that out. That wasn't really okay. I regret that joke and I apologize for it.
Wow.
Just, yeah.
So that's part of the risk of backing things on Kickstarter. Because there are things, there's some pretty big projects that were gadgety things. I don't remember even what they were exactly, where they raised millions of dollars, I think, on Kickstarter. And incredible amounts of money anyway, hundreds of thousands. And then worked on a thing for a while and eventually just were like, this is not going to happen, but we spent all the money. Sorry, Kickstarter backers. That's just a danger of Kickstarter. They're just like, oh, well, we couldn't make the dream come true, so there's nothing. And also, we still have your money. Well, we don't. We spent it. But you also don't have it.
It's just gone.
It's gone.
Somebody else has it now.
But overall, I like Kickstarter. I'm afraid of it. I think at some point we will probably end up attempting to release a game via Kickstarter.
Please don't. Don't make me do that.
Yeah, like the fact that we haven't done it yet is because it's just such a huge, daunting monstrosity.
Listen, let me go get a prescription for something for anxiety first so that I can handle that period of time.
Yeah.
Just good Lord, that sounds like it'll ruin my mental state.
Yeah, so good luck to you, Chip, and anyone else running Kickstarters. We hope you do well. We're glad we're not you at this point in time.
And you're probably glad you're not us.
Because you're probably going to make some money on your Kickstarter game, and we're sadly sitting here drinking in the dark, talking to one another into microphones as though anyone were listening.
Chip listened.
That's right.
Chip's now our best friend.
But they're not listening right now.
Oh, man.
He's our new best friend.
Yeah.
He's like...
yeah, he admitted to listening to the podcast and, like, interacted with it.
He's like...
via live tweet.
Oh, God, what have I done?
Well... Honey, child, get in the car. We're leaving for Uzbekistan now. They can't find us there.
Uzbekistan.
Neither of them can spell it.
O-O-Z. B- no?
No.
Okay.
Joke's on you, Chip. I'm very good at geography.
And I'm actually pretty good at spelling.
Oh my goodness gracious.
But not podcasting. This is horrible.
This is a great podcast. It's brilliant. It's
brilliant, brilliant, brilliant.
It's brilliant.
All right.
Is that?
We should probably.
Is that enough?
We should be done.
Yeah, we should probably.
We should stop inflicting this on our listeners.
Yeah, that's fair enough. All right. So that's the podcast for today, everybody. Glad you could make it out tonight to the. To the theater where we've been doing this.
What if we were actually, there was a live studio audience this whole time, but they were just so unimpressed that they were dead silent the whole time.
That would be unsurprising.
Just a theater full of hundreds of people just kind of glaring at us.
They're all, it's like an old-timey theater, so they're all like completely dressed
they're
to
all,
the nines.
Yeah, done up.
Yeah, very fancy types, just furiously looking at us.
Through opera glasses.
You can't tell because this is an auditory medium, but I'm making a very intense glare face
stern,
right now.
Yeah. So you should check out Chip's Kickstarter, which we mentioned previously and will also be in the show notes. So you can just click the link and not have to type things that I say into an address bar. You can also find him on Twitter. He is, I'm going to get it right this time, the_flying_sheep. And you can tell us about your Kickstarter experiences or that you bought this game and you're so thankful that we introduced you to it that you want to just start sending us money every month for the rest of time as a thank you or whatever. But you could tell us all those nice things and other nice things, just please only nice things, on Twitter at Mildly Alarming.
You could send us an email at mildlyalarmingshow@gmail.com.
Or you could leave a comment on the website at www.mildlyalarming.com or in a 5-star review on Stitcher or iTunes.
Or you could just talk to a dog and the dog will tell us what you said.
Arf.
Arf.
See you next week.
Good night, everybody. The Mildly Alarming Podcast is made possible by an unlocked door at the recording studio, a series of easily guessed passwords and security questions, and Johannes' ability to subdue a security guard by just flexing until the veins in his neck get all bulgy and gross.